San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer. Welcome to It's Your Money and Your Life with 50,000 watts of power coming at you from San Diego and beautiful Kearny Mesa, KFMB, live in our studios. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up to Seattle on a good night when conditions are right. And every Sunday night is a good night here out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour, my co-host, a CPA extraordinaire, family office expert who counsels several high net worth families, marathon enthusiast and a runner, great family man and all around good guy, Richard Muzio. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. It feels good here in the air conditioning in the studio.
Can you believe that? 80 degrees at this time?
And getting warmer as the week goes.
Yeah, well, tonight's whole show is about climate, so we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah,
and I forgot to mention that you are a core member of STAR San Diego Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable, and I always fumble that, but tonight I said it properly. So
perfect.
Hey, we're going to talk baseball too. Just at the outset here, and did you? I know you're a Cards fan,
and I'm a Yankees fan.
Yeah, well, I'm not.
Ugh.
I am not, but I am an Atlanta Braves fan. I am a Padres fan, and I am a Ryan Klesko fan. And Ryan, you're on the line tonight, aren't you? Are you on there? Where is he? He's supposed to be on the line. Anyway, we're going to have him on in a second. Ryan actually did win a World Series with the Atlanta Braves. Played many years in '95. You tell me when, Justin. Oh, he's not. Oh, Dan's on. All right. Well, we'll get back to Ryan in a second. He's supposed to be on the line, and
we'll talk to him when he calls in.
Yeah. But how do you assess the playoffs so far, Richard? Just to talk.
Well, the Yankees are finished. Yeah, I mean, they just lost two at home. Derek Jeter broke his ankle, which is really tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And they've seen more bad calls in two games than.
They've had their share go their way too.
Oh, really? I can't remember any.
When they were playing the Padres, when we hit that home run, and that little kid who was playing hooky reached over the right field.
No, that was the Baltimore Orioles, Yankees.
They did it to us too, I think.
The pitch Langston threw down the middle to Tino Martinez in the World Series was strike three, and the ump called it ball three, and then he hit a grand slam.
Well, I'm talking about the Padres.
No, that was in the Yankees' favor. That was in the World Series back in '98.
Yeah, in the World Series. There you go. We got swept 4-0, so unfortunately. But anyway, so maybe it's karma. I don't know. But Justin, is he there yet or not yet? Oh, well.
He's going to let us know, Joe.
He'll call back.
We'll talk to him when he calls.
Yeah. But anyway, you want to talk about what happened last week with the art auction a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Our event, we announced our event last week, the Brighter Side, Mary and Sherry, had over 200 people at their Stamp Out Breast Cancer event and raised thousands of dollars for two great charities.
Excellent.
And really well attended, and a bunch of art got sold. Some great people showed up. It was a lot of fun. It never rained. It was predicted to rain Thursday night last week, but it did not. And it was a super event because so much money got raised, so many people showed up and had a great time. And of course, again, October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and so it was a great event.
Right. And I have been in touch with Carol LeBeau, and I do believe she'll be involved with some more events that are coming up.
We send our best wishes to her because... Yeah. She's recovering.
She is recovering.
Which is great.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I think, I don't know if Ryan's going to call back in. Okay. Well, let's get right into tonight's topic then, because it's important, and I don't think we've ever devoted, and I can't recall any show in town here who's devoted an entire hour to climate science, climate research, and we are going to do that tonight. And we have with us two esteemed scientists from... Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Oh, wait a minute. We think Ryan's calling. I love live radio, don't you, Richard?
It's great stuff. Talk to him.
All right.
Baseball.
Ryan Klesko, are you on the air?
I am.
Oh, my gosh. Good to hear you. I got a co-host here, Richard Muzio. Say hi, Richard.
Hey, Ryan. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Good. Hey, we wanted to talk about, obviously, you live in Atlanta, and you follow the Braves games quite a bit. What happened in the playoffs? So you guys got skunked on a bad call again, or what?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was one of those ones where, I guess the umpire didn't know where the ball was at. Obviously, it was a little bit further back.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys, going back behind him, the outfielder's coming in. It's just not a simple, you know, infield fly, you know. And I think that the guy just blew the call. I mean, it didn't, in my opinion, it just, you know, it was a bad deal, you know.
Yeah. And what I thought, I thought he called it way too late. If he was going to call it, he should have called it sooner.
Yeah, that's what they usually do. They usually throw their hands up, like, literally early.
Yeah, you know? Early. You're supposed to throw it up early.
Yeah, you throw it up early, and it's just, I mean, I ain't seen anything like that in a long time. But then again, you know, it reminded me almost like a replacement umpire in NFL.
Yeah, and then talk about bad luck. The Yankees, not only does Jeter break his ankle last night, but today, the whole world saw, the ump calls this guy. There's a base hit goes out to right field. A guy's rounding second. He heads a little bit too far to third, tries to get back. He definitely gets tagged out at second, trying to get back into second base. The ump called him safe, and it led to a couple more Detroit runs. Although the Yanks did get shut out, and you know, so who can say whether it was a factor in the loss? But my question to you is, and it kind of relates to the show tonight, because everybody saw that was an error, and this one guy who's making the call, you know, has it wrong. So technology, and I know the manager of the Yankees, Girardi, he's calling for, you know, replays in the playoffs. And what's your opinion? Don't you think we should get to something like that, like they have for football?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they should have at least, you know, I don't know if they'd give them, you know, one, maybe they're allowed one just like a call where
a challenge,
they have to repeat it. Like, maybe one call where they can do it, you know, like a replay or something. And, you know, and it's got to be certain things. It can be balls and strikes and stuff like that. But, you know, something like that, you know, they should be able to decide. And, you know, especially in the playoffs or in the size of games, you know, maybe the last, you know. But it's just one of those things where, you know, you want to let the game play out. But, you know, I played a long time, and I've seen some brutal calls. And these guys are, you know, they can slow-mo it all they want, but the umpire's seeing everything in just full, fast.
Right.
You know, not to, you know, stick up for him, but, you know, I played in that playoffs where, you know, where we played the Marlins, which was a terrible balls and strikes deal. Mm-hmm. The umpire was calling balls that were, you know, off the plate, not just 3, 4, 5 inches. We're talking about 8 inches, 12 inches off the plate.
Oh, my God.
And it was probably, if you go back and review that game, it was crazy. We had bases loaded, and the catcher was sitting basically in the other batter's box on the other side of the line.
that was Eric Gregg, if you want to recall.
Eric Gregg. Eric Gregg and LeVon Hernandez.
Exactly. I mean, LeVon Hernandez, who can't strike a guy out to save his life, had like about 12 punch-outs.
Well, they ought to give those umps a little blood alcohol test or something. I don't know.
You felt you fight all season to get there, and then you have a game like that.
I know.
I can foul a pitch that's 3 or 4 inches off the plate off it, man. When it's in the other batter's box, and it just got, I mean, you get plays like that. You know, I've had crazy stuff. You know, I've played a long time, but, you know, I hit a ball off of my Roger Clemens, my first time I ever faced him. It was a line drive. It hit the seats in center field and bounced back into the field, and I gave it a double.
You hit it too hard.
So you hit 200. You hit 279 dingers, but you got credit for 278.
Yeah. Well, I had one that hit the foul pole that they called foul. I mean, it ricochets off the foul pole, and these guys, you know, that the crew chief doesn't want to show up the young guy and make him look bad. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy things that happen, and you know, you're going to see a lot of it because these guys aren't perfect, you know, the balls and strike thing, that makes it tough, but I mean. I don't know. Maybe if they can put it under review where the guy's literally making bad decisions, you know, maybe they can, you know, switch umpires in the game or something. But again, it's an issue where, you know, the guy's going to feel like, you know, his integrity's taken away. But there's just a lot of mistakes that go on.
I'm more concerned about the calls, you know, at first base, and these other tag plays and whatnot. But anyway, Ryan, so we're down to Detroit and the Yankees and the Giants and the Cards. So who do you like to go all the way? Any particular?
Any given time, whoever's playing the best, you know, the Cardinals are coming on strong. I'm watching it. Mm-hmm. I'm watching the Giants make a comeback. It was 6-0. And now it's 6-4. They just scored 4 runs with 2 outs. And the Giants are a scrappy team.
Yeah, they all are.
They're scrappy, and they're down. Like I said, they were down 6-0. Now it's 6-4, and they just got another hit now. And you know, just it's not always. Obviously, it's not the best team with a record because obviously the Nationals are out of it. But you know, who's playing best at the, who's playing hottest when, as they go into the playoffs.
Yeah.
And man, the Cardinals just look tough. I think that the Giants pitching is a little bit better. The offense is starting to come around. You know, in the American League, I mean, look at Baltimore's done, and Yankees, and you know, I mean, just there's some teams that were hot, and I don't know. It's just you know, Yankees are Yankees. They got a basically field an all-star team every year, but it's hard to tell. You know, if I had to pick one team that was, if I had to guess, it would be the Cardinals, because they never say die,
for God's sakes.
Yeah, and they have that feeling like they can do it any time, but. You never know. I mean, it's
well, you've got one record we should mention, because you know, of all the years in baseball and all the hundreds of records, I mean, you've got the one, and Richard knows this now too, but you're the only guy in Major League Baseball to hit a home run in three consecutive road games in a World Series final. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I guess so. I can't believe anybody hasn't broken it, but I guess I'm still a holder of it, I suppose.
Some guys, a lot have two, but no one has three. So
1995, Cleveland Indians against the Indians.
That is correct. So Ryan, when's the next time you going to be in San Diego? Any plans to be out to the West Coast? I know your mom lives up in Orange County.
Oh, yeah. A good friend of mine, Rusty, he lives there.
Mm-hmm.
Go see them. Got family in San Clemente. Got a lot of friends in San Diego, so we usually make it down probably twice a year. Looks like now, probably sometime December. Usually right after Christmas.
And yeah,
I was there for Trevor Hoffman's great deal they had, and that was a good day.
They retired his number. That was a terrific day. So
yeah, and all those guys, you know, Trevor's still around, and Loretta and Brad Austin, some of those guys are all still around. And I know there's been a lot of stuff going on with the Padres. Did they resell again?
Yeah, the deal with the O'Malley family closed.
Yep, the O'Malley's on them now.
Yeah,
so.
It did. So they said they're going to spend some money.
Good.
I know. I mean, it's about time to spend some money, get some players.
Yeah. Anyway, Rhino, we've got some two climate scientists on tonight. We want to get to that because we know you're an outdoorsman, so we want to preserve the climate for you. So we have to get to the rest of the show. But thanks for calling, and we'll be in touch with you, okay?
All right, man.
All right.
Thanks, Ryan.
Nice talking to you. Good luck with everything. All right. Whew, he finally called in. Anyway, on the line, we should also have a script scientist, the esteemed Dan Kahan. Dan, are you there?
I am here. How are you?
Great. Thanks for your patience. I hope you're a baseball fan, but Ryan was a favorite Padre in town here, and I'm sure people enjoyed hearing what he had to say. So,
yeah.
But Dan, you are one of the foremost climate scientists in the state, maybe in the country, maybe beyond. And how long have you been at Scripps Institution of Oceanography?
Well, that's a little embarrassing, but I came as a graduate student in the late 70s, and somehow they never
let you go. Well, that was 77. I do see it on. You know, well, that's the year I got to San Diego, and boy, the climate sure has changed here. But anyway, so you got your doctorate. Or, let's see here. You got your bachelor's in meteorology and oceanography from the University of Michigan, 71, and then you got your doctorate in oceanography in 1990 from UCSD, and then you've been at Scripps ever since there, correct?
Yeah, well, that's a contorted path, but that's accurate.
Good. And then your real bailiwick or specialty is the water resources. Is that it more or less? Or
yeah, climate impacts in the region, but water is certainly a focus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now you were one of the lead authors in the first climate study commissioned by Governor Schwarzenegger in what, 05, 06? Was that, do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And you're just up to the third assessment. So maybe we can hit a few of the highlights. And what have you seen that's changed from the first study to the current report?
Well, it's actually been sort of a continuous message where it's pretty clear that warming and other impacts are going to affect this region along with elsewhere on the globe.
Mm-hmm.
We're expecting something in the neighborhood of 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the middle of this century, and
which is fairly daunting because how much did it increase last century?
Well, it's approximately a degree. It depends exactly on which region and so forth, but a degree is a pretty good round number.
Yeah. Well, we're concerned about San Diego, of course, the Western States region, right, Richard?
Yeah. We are, but we're also concerned about music.
Ah, yes. Dan, can you please stay tuned? We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Not Theirs after this short announcement.
KFMB.
All right, is your money and your life? I got a little ahead of myself there, Richard.
No, a little bit behind yourself.
Behind
yourself, not ahead of yourself.
It is your money and your life, and welcome back with Richard Musio, myself, Dr. Dan Kagan on the line, Dr. Jeff Servinghaus, who we'll get to in a little bit in the studio. But Dan, are you back with us?
Hey, Dan, this is Richard. I have a question for you. Can you hear us still?
Yeah, I can.
I moved to San Diego in 1969.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've been here longer, I guess, than anybody. We never used to have summers like we have now where it's so humid. I mean, we just didn't back then. So what has changed here?
Well, I do have to say that there's a lot of variability in our climate on many timescales, including decades. And I have not seen real defined changes in humidity, although some of what I will say is that some of the hottest spells that we've had appear to be becoming more humid. And, for example, the 2006 intense heat wave that was long-lasting was one in which the humidity played a big role because it's effective in keeping nighttime temperatures warm as well as daytime. And that's probably been the largest nighttime heat wave that we've had in the observed record. Mm-hmm. So there may be something to what you're saying, Richard. It's just that it kind of comes and goes. And mm-hmm. I think this last summer we've had some of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last couple of months when I don't know that it certainly wasn't as extreme as 06, but it was close because it kept going and going and going on.
Yeah. But about the water situation, Dan, because I know that's your main area of expertise or one of them, and they say Lake Powell and Lake Mead are, 50% down and maybe bone dry by 2020? Is it still heading in that direction?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern in the Southwest because of these dry spells that we've had that have been pretty recurrent since the late 90s. And, and of course, we live at the end of two pipelines here in San Diego County, one being the Colorado, the other being from Northern California. So a lot of interest in what happens in the Southwest. The Colorado seems to be of the major basins, watersheds in the West, the one that's the most susceptible to climate warming. That is, the warmer it gets, the more it suffers by way of losing a lot of the runoff that sustains the Colorado water supply.
Evaporation, are we talking? Or
yeah, evaporation and the way that plants take water in and transpire it, so we call that evapotranspiration.
Hmm.
But all that working together in an arid climate is a setting that kind of exacerbates the warming and the dry spells that are inevitable to occur from decade to decade.
Now, you mentioned before the break that it's predicted that we may have an increase in Fahrenheit temperature of about 2.5 points.
Yeah, that's kind of there's a range of temperatures. None of this is real well defined, but I would say that every climate model that's being run these days is showing warming. Some a little less and some more, so that that's a pretty good round number by the middle of the century. And by the end of the century, we're seeing increases of 3 to possibly 8 degrees Fahrenheit. We hope, of course, that we're not going to ride on the upper end of that trajectory, because that will have just real profound impacts on on just about every sector, including human health and ecosystems.
Oh, I mean, 8 points. We're all going to have camels as pets. I mean, it's... I mean, I couldn't imagine 8 degrees hotter consistently in San Diego.
Yeah, that's a scenario that is hard to believe. And you can, of course, choose your favorite inland city.
But what factors would have to be in place to cause something that extreme?
Well, it's dependent on the loading of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and I think Jeff will probably talk more about that when he gets on. But the change in the atmospheric composition of carbon dioxide, which is one of the primary greenhouse gases, has already reached about 40% above the level it was before industrialization. And if we're lucky, that level will only double by the end of the century. And if we're not so lucky, it could triple. And of course, this is because we're using carbon-based fuels, fossil fuels, carbon that's been buried in the earth, essentially, in the form of oil and coal and so forth. And that's getting loaded in the atmosphere. That a lot of the greenhouse gases, especially CO2, have very long residence times, so a century or more. And consequently, the additional greenhouse gases, which are not transparent to the radiation that's escaping from the Earth's surface, are causing the Earth's surface to heat up. We're committed to a certain amount of warming, even if we curtail fossil fuel burning today. But if we continue at the present level, which, of course, is increasing rapidly, not only in the United States, but in developing countries, including especially China, India, and Brazil, the levels of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are going to keep increasing. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's a reason for international attention to this problem and, mm-hmm. and a lot of negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we find an alternative to fossil fuels. It doesn't seem like there's any silver or magic bullet these days yet, but, we've got some, electric cars and things, being developed right now and whatnot. But anyway, Dan, thanks very much. I think we've got our second break coming up here. But thank you for being with us. If you want to hang around, please do. And we'll be back with more of It's Your Money.
And Your Life.
And Your Life right after these announcements. Stay tuned.
Now, It's Your Money and Your Life on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
All right, we are back with It's Your Money and Your Life. Over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
Hey, first we want to congratulate Felix Baumgartner for breaking the speed of sound with that leap that he did. That's incredible.
That is.
And thanks for Dan Cayenne for calling in. Also, Ryan Klesko, thanks for calling in. I don't know if people know this, but Ryan Klesko hit 278 home runs in the big leagues. That's a lot of home runs.
Yep.
All right, our sponsors, thank you to UBS, Mr. Michael Quarantra and Drew Freitas. Sean Puckett with Regions Bank. Signature Analytics, run by the great Jason Kruger, CPA. Joel Grushkin and Cost Segregation Initiatives. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Dawn Epic and Paul Polito, Polito Epic CPAs. Carl Sheeler and Business Valuations Limited. And last but not least, and he also had a very successful event last Thursday, Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal. So everybody, thank you very much. We couldn't do it without you. So
Absolutely.
We very much appreciate it.
And might I reference, in case you'd like to contact any of them, they're all experts in their field, as is Richard. But if you go to our website, iymoney.com, there is a sponsor page there, and their contact information is there and everything else that you need to know.
We even have biographies
where
about half the information is true.
No, it's really
it's
great.
All true.
And thanks to Courtney for setting that up. This is getting fine-tuned and getting better by the week, so there's just a lot of great information there. But anyway, we have Dr. Jeff Severinghouse in the house with us tonight. He is another esteemed researcher, climate scientist from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which was founded in 1903, And anyway, I don't want to take any more time to introduce him. I want to bring him right on now. Dr. Jeff Severinghaus, good evening. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your patience. I apologize for everything.
No worries.
But and thanks to Dan Kahan, too, because that was valuable. But now you got your PhD, let's see. Well, tell us a little bit about your educational background.
At Columbia in New York, at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which is basically the geology and earth science branch of Columbia.
Mm-hmm. And then your master's before that, UC Santa Barbara?
UC Santa Barbara.
Right.
Yeah,
and then your undergrad in Oberlin in 83. So, but, you know, Scripps Institution, what, you know, it is an institution. And you were telling us at the break, you know, it is what, the oldest meteorological and climate science?
Oldest oceanographic institution
not meteorological.
In the country. Yeah.
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 So,
and the reason that UCSD exists.
That's right. Yeah, the director of Scripps decided he wanted to have a university nearby, so he started one. That's how we got UCSD.
And that was the fabled Dr. Roger Revelle, who actually started. When you think about it, you know, your institution was there, and UCSD was not until what, 64, I think, something like that, right?
Yeah. That's
but
right.
You have 1,300 employees, 375 PhDs with all kinds of research going on all over the globe. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's quite an astonishing place. And, you know, I have to admit, I'm kind of ashamed of this, but there's a lot of people there I don't even know. You know, it's really embarrassing. I'm like sitting on the bus and the person next to me says, you know, where do you work? Oh, I work at Scripps. Oh, I do too. Oh, how come I don't know you? It's just such a big place that we don't all know each other, you know.
Well,
that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, you're concerned with more global issues than Dan?
That's right. You know, I'm trying to reconstruct the history of the atmosphere using bubbles of air that are trapped in Antarctic ice. So I do a lot of work down there in Antarctica, and I go take ice cores. We just finished drilling one that's 2 miles long.
Wow!
Yeah,
you went down. You went down 2 miles.
That's right.
Bringing
up the ice in little bits and pieces. Of course, each one is about.
And when you get to the very bottom of that, how many years ago does that represent? Would you say
we bottomed out at 62,000 years ago?
Wow!
So you can tell what was going on in the climate just by virtue of reading the gas bubbles.
That's right. It's like a big book. You know, it's just. It's amazing. The every year it snows, and it's so cold down there, it doesn't melt. So it just piles up and piles up and piles up.
It's like
up.
Tree
so,
rings.
Exactly.
More.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You got these layers, and we can actually count them just like tree rings. So somebody in our, I didn't do this myself, but somebody in our group patiently counted, you know, all these layers.
Unbelievable.
Quite, yeah.
So what have been some of your key findings, would you say, from some of your recent research?
I think the most important one probably is that by studying the air that's trapped in bubbles, we learn about what's happening in places like the tropics where, you know, gases like methane and different forms of oxygen are produced by photosynthesis. And so what we found is that when the climate changes abruptly in Greenland, there's also big changes in the rainfall in the tropics, and this is kind of a surprise. This is not something that people who study the tropics were really aware of until we started telling them, "Hey, you guys need to go back and look at your records, you know, and see if what did lakes change? Were there changes in vegetation?" And sure enough, there have been these huge changes in tropical rainfall in the past. And what I think it tells us is that when we talk about global warming, we're really kind of missing part of the big story here. That the change in rainfall, you know, for all the people who make their living in the tropics off of the rainfall, could be much more significant in impact than a few degrees of temperature increase. So maybe by focusing on temperature, maybe we're missing the big story, and that it really. It could be rainfall change that is where we're gonna feel it. You know?
So by studying these ice cores, in Antarctica, you can tell what's going on in the tropics.
Yeah, it's amazing. But the atmosphere is well mixed within on a time scale of 1 year. The whole atmosphere mixes, and so if you just take a sample of air from anywhere, you can get an answer about what's happening on a global scale. And it turns out that that we know from making measurements directly in the tropics that almost all the methane is made in the tropics, and most of the oxygen is actually made in the tropics too. So basically, by looking at methane and oxygen, we can learn about conditions in the tropics on a very broad sort of average scale.
And then with the growth of the human population and you know, the human footprint, what percentage of those gases would you say have increased over the, I guess, past 150 years or so? Is there any way of measuring what we've done? Or
sure, that's the one really nice things about these air trapped in bubbles. We can figure out, you know, what the gas concentration was before the Industrial Revolution. And so, for example, carbon dioxide has gone up about 40% due to human activities since about 1850, and we, you know, we can see from the ice core records that it was pretty much, you know, stable for the past 10,000 years. And it, so, you know, if you look at a graph of 10,000 years of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration, it's this big flat line. And then at the very end, there's this little thing sticking up. You know,
it's the hockey stick.
That's right. The ultimate hockey stick is the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere.
So, you and your colleagues, did you talk about, you know, what kind of measures we should? I know Dan's reports a lot about adaptation, but what does that mean? What do we have to do to adapt to a lot of the
buy an air conditioner?
that was my comment on the break. I think I'm going to invest in an air conditioning repair company. But for example, the effect this would have, for example, on agriculture, growing food.
Yeah, so I mean that's a huge issue. The, you know, we already irrigate so much, you know, in the dry parts of the southwestern United States that we're sort of insulated from sudden changes in rainfall. But there's a lot of people in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, in Asia, who make their living on rainfall. And so, yeah, so I mean, in some ways, the biggest impact of climate change might be political instability in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, we're used to, the Pentagon's used to considering, you know, one failed state at a time. Well, what if you had 25 failed states all at once?
I mean, that's what, here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, you know, that scenario would promote additional poverty. Additional poverty promotes additional political instability. At least that's how I view the world.
Right.
So, because you would imagine it would affect low income or no income people more than it would the wealthy.
That's right.
By definition.
And the, you know, risk analysis usually assumes that there's random events, you know, like insurance companies say, well, there's some random probability that you'll have a fire, you know, in your house, right? But the thing about climate change is it affects everybody all at the same time. And so you can't think of it as a random thing anymore. I mean, it's more like, it's like the banks saying, well, you know, it's unlikely that all the banks are going to go belly up all at once, right? Guess what? You know, I think we need to start thinking more systemically about failed states and
what
rainfall
to do
and stuff like
that. Well, I bet there's people in our intelligence department and the Pentagon that are probably studying this, aren't there?
Oh, I think there are.
So anyway, that's an interesting offshoot of this that people don't typically think about. I didn't think about much about that. Did you, Richard? The failed state as a result of climate change?
Yeah, I mean, I've always, again, sort of associated failed states with people who are impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, people get pushed to the brink and then there's uprisings.
Not to mention,
or states that just fail. I mean, you know, you look at countries like Zimbabwe or whatever. Yeah. I mean, just a total and complete failed state.
No, we had that horrible tsunami. More people living near the coastal regions. And then, of course, if you get a catastrophe like that tsunami, that was
Well, terrible. If it's predicted that water levels are going to rise and more people live on the coast, what does that portend for the future?
Yeah. And now the sea level rise is an issue, right, Jeff?
Another one, yeah. Well, I look at sea level rise as sort of a gradual problem. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be abrupt.
Right.
You know, we're talking 3 feet by the 2100, so end of this century. You know, and so for most of us, that's probably not a big deal. I mean, certainly for San Diegans, it's not a big deal. If you live in a place like Bangkok, where you've got, you know, 5 million people living, you know, within a meter of sea level. That mm-hmm. that's some worse.
Or some of these island communities too, right?
Yeah. And of course, it's not the average sea level that really matters. What matters is the high water mark during mm-hmm. a storm, you know, or some mm-hmm. you know big flood event.
I think Florida and Manhattan, you know, projecting what a few centuries ahead, I guess. But anyway. Let's come back to talk with Dr. Jeff Stebbinghaus more after this break. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Stay tuned. All right, we're back in the home stretch for It's Your Money and Your Life. God, we only have about 5 minutes left here, Richard.
Let me ask Jeff a question. So, Jeff, yes. we've mentioned that we have increasing heat risk. We've mentioned that we have increasing water risk. There's no doubt that demand for energy is increasing and projected to continue to do so. What are some possible solutions to this, well, rather precarious situation?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on, you know, the politics and the economics of it. So here I just want to make it clear that I'm speaking as a private citizen. I'm not speaking as a, you know, scientist.
So noted.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I'm actually an optimist. I really think that there is a way out of this mess, and that is to remove the carbon dioxide directly from the atmosphere. And the technology to do this is now being developed. It's actually possible. And bury it underground and bury it in deep ocean sediments where it turns into a solid mm-hmm. form. It's called a clathrate. It's like mm-hmm. ice, you know, and it's very stable. And I think I think this can be done safely. And the good news about it, I think, is that instead of having new taxes, which everybody seems to hate the idea of new taxes, you just put a disposal fee on carbon at the wellhead, and it's simple to administer. None of this complex stuff about carbon trading, and you know, mm-hmm. So when somebody takes coal out of the ground or oil out of the ground, they just have to pay a disposal fee, and that mm-hmm. goes into a fund that pays for the removal, safe removal of the CO2 from
the atmosphere.
It's like
paying for trash removal. We have
yeah.
to pay for
and,
that.
And the nice thing is that there's no you know, worry that the money will be misused for other purposes because, mm-hmm. you know, it's just for that. Mm-hmm. Nothing else. There's a firewall. It's not like a tax where it goes into the general revenues.
Into the general deficit?
Well, that makes certain good sense.
And that also sends the right price signals because then, you know, it makes fossil fuels slightly more expensive. No, we're not talking a big, you know, we're talking 0.5% or something. We're talking about a small thing. But anyway, it sends a subtle price signal that makes people look harder at wind and solar, which right now are actually not playing on a level playing field, as it turns out, because fossil fuels get such a big subsidy. So,
and then if you had to make a, you know, I hear these other people in the media criticizing climate change, calling it a hoax and this and that. Why don't you get it off your chest? And just, you know, it just bothers me that other people who don't have the PhDs. You know, the governor Schwarzenegger said, you know, if 98 doctors tell me my kid is sick and two tell me he is, and I'm going with the 98.
Yeah.
Well, Willie Brown once told me that safe streets and trash pickup are not political issues, and I would argue that climate change is not a political issue either, but unfortunately it's become one.
Yeah, I think at its root, it really is the ultimate apolitical issue. It's a lot like sewage treatment. I mean, pretty much everybody agrees that sewage treatment is a good thing. You don't hear it being, you know, discussed on Sean Hannity. You mm-hmm. don't hear it, you know, Rush Limbaugh doesn't talk about how sewage treatment is a communist plot, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that climate will be understood, you know, eventually that way. We'll look back on this, you know, 50 years from now and we'll say, oh, they were arguing about sewage treatment back then. But if you look at history, it's very interesting. The sewage treatment wasn't always accepted. You know, go back 150 years, and there were a lot of conservatives who were arguing that sewage treatment plants would wreck the economy because it did actually cost a lot, believe it or not, to do good sewage treatment. And at the time, it was something like 1% of the economy. It was that's not a small number.
Well, the auto industry fought seatbelts for a long while. I mean, it's the consumers, the people have to make their voices heard, and hopefully we've helped to do that tonight a little bit. Right, Richard?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, Frank Partnoy's book, Wait, you know, Frank was a guest on our show a few months ago. He talked about making decisions that affect a multitude of future generations, and obviously climate change, I think, is one of those issues where political leaders need to look beyond 4 years, 8 years, or even 50 years and say over 100 years, 200 years, what are the decisions that we're making going to do based on science?
Mm-hmm. And then Jeff made a good point about everyone says they care about their grandkids, but what was your remark about that? We only see as far as the tip of our nose a lot of times too, right?
Yeah, it's hard to get someone to invest a dollar now, even if it's going to pay back $10,000 in 100 years, because we're all, unsure, and there's uncertainty, and so people discount the future. Yeah.
But anyway, thank you, Dr. Jeff Servinghaus. So we have to really get off the air right now. But thank you, Richard. Have a great week.
You too.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks to Ryan Klesko, Dr. Dan Kahan, and also to the rest of our staff here at KFMB. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next Sunday night. Good night now.
I believe I can do anything. So when it came to learning a new language, I knew I had to do it the way I learn. No books, no memorizing or translating. I wanted to learn the same way I learned my first language, naturally. That's why I chose Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone invites you to be a part of its biggest language learning event in history. Because in 2012, we want to help 3 million people learn a new language. That's why we're going to give you an absolutely free demo of our language immersion technology. To participate in this free nationwide event, just call 1-800-500-1357.
Si yo puedo hacerlo, usted puede hacerlo. If I can do it, you can do it.
To participate in this free nationwide event, call now for your free demo from Rosetta Stone. Call 1-800-500-1357. That's 1-800-500-1357.
We follow the story.
Watch out, middle class. The tax bill is coming to you.
Then we leave the conversation.
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
Follow the leader. 760 KFM.